Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interest outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 3 features physicists involved in the long-range plan for nuclear science. I hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Welcome back, everyone. Bill, I'm here with Kinza.
Hi. So today we are happy to have Abhay with us. Thank you for joining us. To get started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so first of all, very happy to be here talking to you. My name is Abhay Deshpande. I'm a professor at Stony Brook University. And the last few years, I also have a joint appointment with Brookhaven National Lab as the Electron Ion Collider Director of Science. I have been at Stony Brook for the last 20 years or so. Before that, I was a researcher at the Riken Bienstadt Center, which was headed by T.D. Lee at Brookhaven National Lab. It was a center that promoted the polarized proton program, the spin physics program at RIC, supported by the Japanese government. And before that, I was a postdoc at Yale, did my research at CERN mainly at that time. And before that, I was also a graduate student at Yale. So overall, over the last 25, 30 years of my research life, I've worked at Brookhaven Lab, at Jefferson Lab more recently, as well as CERN and DAISY.
Could you go into a little bit more detail about your research or work as the electron ion collider person?
So it all started with my entry as a postdoc at an experiment at CERN, which was looking for understanding how much of the proton's spin comes from the quark's alignment. So if you simply ask, where does this proton spin come from? The intuition is that its constituents should make up the proton spin. And there was an experiment at CERN at that time that discovered that might not be the case as far as the quarks are concerned, meaning quarks might not be aligned with the proton spin. And that was a big surprise. And we wanted to see whether that was true. And we dwelled deeper into it and understood that, in fact, only 25% approximately of the proton spin really comes from quarks. That led me to the next question as to where is the remaining spin? And again, speculations were that the remaining spin came from the gluons that bind the quarks and anti-quarks together. So at that time, I moved to Brookhaven to do a polarized proton-proton collision in a collider at 250 GeV beams, that means 500 GeV center of mass energy. And we explored whether the gluons carry the proton spin. And over the last 15, 20 years, we have measured it, and it comes out that almost about 25% of the remaining part also comes from the gluons. So now we account for about 50% of the proton spin, with the caveat that if you look at the distribution of momenta of what we have measured of the quarks and gluons, it is not a complete range in the distribution of momenta. It's only a fixed fraction. And to overcome that, to go to smaller and smaller momentum fractions of these quarks and gluons, we really need to go to a different device, and that's the electron ion collider. And that's how I was originally thinking about it, what, 25 years ago, how to do that and to think about a collider, a new type of collider, where instead of a proton colliding on a proton, we hit an electron on a polarized proton and try to understand that remaining part. It turns out that it also starts giving us answers to the remaining mystery of the proton spin, which means that not only does the spin of the proton come from the alignment of quarks and gluons, but there is a motion of those quarks and gluons inside the proton. And since they cannot come out, there is a natural rotational motion or orbital angular momentum of the momenta of the quarks and gluons. And that's what we want to measure. It turns out the best way to do that is also do an electron proton scattering. So this future collider that we are now building at Brookhaven National Lab, it will not only measure the remaining momentum fraction that comes from quarks and gluons alignment, that was sort of the remaining, but also will measure the orbital angular momentum of quarks and gluons. So that has been my central theme of my research, but it has expanded into two different additional areas. One is understanding the nucleus with the same electron scattering, a structure of the nucleus, and it is proposed by the current knowledge of quantum chromodynamics that extremely high energies would change the nucleus into a very, very high density gluonic object. It's a very high density gluon wall. It is predicted by our current understanding of QCD. And if it does exist, we don't know whether it exists, and it should exist is what tells me, but we have never experimentally confirmed it. And so that has very interesting properties. It has a very, very high density. Then the densities are estimated, of course, calculated by theoretical models, to be 50 to 100 times more dense than the core of the neutron star. And it's that's the case, then we have never seen any object in nature that is of that kind. So it's very interesting to see whether that really exists. And if it does, then what are the properties of it? Is it really that dense or not? So that's an experimental avenue that I'm pursuing as research beyond the spin and understanding the spin of the proton. And just from my own interests for using, you know, technology as spin as an observable, I'm also interested in exploring the limits of the standard model using spin. So, for example, if I can make measurements with spin-dependent scattering so precisely that it challenges the standard model calculations, then I am adding new information to the knowledge and the limits of the standard model. And so I'm involved with the Moeller experiment at Jefferson Lab, which does an electron-electron scattering and then tries to really see if there is physics beyond the standard model through precision, as against LHC, which does it through large energy. LHC is the energy frontier. I called our experiment at Moeller, like experiment, the low energy, but high precision, parts per billion accuracy, allows us to get to the same kind of physics beyond the standard model, but on the precision frontier. So that's the kind of experiments I dwell in. Use spin to either do, you know, knowledge of standard model QCD or push it to the limit to go beyond the standard model.
That's really awesome. I think that was like very well put. You just explained so many topics of our questions in physics in such a great way. So I guess maybe a follow-up on that is what's special about the electron ion collider? Why do we need this to study orbital angular momentum and everything more deeply?
So the methods that we will use to measure the orbital angular momentum are such that you need to scatter a virtual photon that can come from the electron that is the main probe of the electron-ion collider, ion being in this case a polarized or unpolarized proton beam. There is a very specific kind of reaction you want to measure. That is a very special one. You have a glass bowl which represents a proton. And the bowl is filled with water, which represent gluons. And there are three ping pong balls, which will represent the quarks. And the whole system is in motion. And if I really want to measure the angular momentum of this system, the glass is stationary, that's not moving, but the water and the ping pong balls are moving, right? The glass is like the boundary of the proton. You would not take a baseball bat and hit it hard with it, because the fact of measuring, looking inside the glass bowl, with this method, you're breaking the system itself, meaning that rotational motion will no longer exist. Instead, to really measure this, you want to go softly inside that bowl and see how much pressure, let's say not with a baseball bat, but a ping pong paddle, and see how much pressure you see because of the glue or because of the ping pong balls hitting the paddle. And to do that is to go with a virtual photon that comes from the electron, go inside the proton, just enough light. That means you go inside and interact with the quark. But the interactions has to be soft enough so that the quark does not get enough energy to leave the proton. That means you don't have enough energy to break the proton, but enough to simply excite the quark. Now, if that really happens, then immediately it will de-excite and release a real photon out, because the energy has to be released. What is the process? It goes to EP, goes to EP and a gamma. The proton remains intact. The electron, of course, is unbreakable, so it always remains intact. But in addition to EP, there is a real photon that comes from the excitation of a quark. And so that's the part, a very unique reaction that we didn't even know existed about 20 years ago, that this can happen. We discovered it in an experiment at HERA called H1 and Zeus 2 experiments, which we are doing collider with high energy EP scattering. And we saw some missing events. We couldn't figure out what the missing events were. And eventually we realized that those were the kind of events that we had accidentally discovered. It's called deeply virtual Compton scattering. So it's Compton scattering because it's a scattering from the photon off of a charged particle, which is the quark, but it's deeply virtual. The quark sits inside the proton, and it's a virtual Compton scattering because it comes from a virtual photon that is the interacting for the first time, coming out of the electron and hitting the quark inside. So that tells you something about the quark. So there, the information about the quark's motion inside the proton is captured by the fact, by the energy coming in and the energy going out through this photon. Yeah. And so we know how to translate back into a spatial distribution of the quarks inside. And then the transverse momentum also comes from a semi-inclusive deep inelastic scattering event where you see what comes out of a quark hitting a quark at the left and right of a detector. So such asymmetries coupled with semi-inclusive deep inelastic scattering, coupled with these deeply virtual Compton scattering, allows us to get a full three-dimensional picture of the quark's position and momentum. So that's the kind of things that we want to do in the electron-ion collider. If you did the same thing with the, instead of a virtual photon hitting a quark, but it interacts with a gluon through a quark-anti-quark production, then what comes out is what we call mesons. And those, you know, JPSR, those particles, similarly, same logic applies backwards, but then they tell you something about the gluon's motion and distribution inside the proton. So those are the kind of experiments we can only do at the electron-ion collider. So that is the very special part of the electron-ion collider that allows us to get to the orbital motion of the quarks and gluons. And as I mentioned before, the original motivation for the electron-ion collider that takes us to the low momentum fractions is also unique. You need a polarized beam of electrons as well as protons. Only collider in the world that will be the electron-ion collider that will allow us to go to the low momentum fractions, which is simply impossible in any other machine. So that's the special part of the electron-ion collider. Nobody's even thinking of replicating.
Thank you. That was really well explained. I was at the EIC summer school at the beginning of June, and you definitely, despite all that lecture, brought my knowledge about the EIC up even more.
You were here at Storybrooke?
Yeah.
That's why your face is familiar.
Yeah.
You said that you mentioned something about a polarized proton beam and an unpolarized beam. So what difference in the results will we get by using a polarized or an unpolarized one?
Polarized proton beam means that in the accelerator, when I say there are protons in the accelerator or in that RIC, for example, they're bunched. There are about 120 bunches, which are spread around 3.8 kilometers of the RIC ring. And those bunches are about 100 centimeters long. It takes about 2 nanoseconds to pass through and 100 nanoseconds apart from each other. Now, when I say the beam is polarized, it means that predominantly the protons are pointing in the direction of the holding field. So typically in the accelerator, the holding field is vertical. And once you put, say, 10 to the 12 bunch protons in this one bunch, there is a distribution which direction they are in. And when I say 70% polarization, it means that 70% of the polarized protons inside that bunch are pointing towards in the same direction as that of the holding field of the accelerator. If it is 50%, then we say 50% polarization. So why do I need that? Because if I want to really understand the spin structure of the proton, I can control the proton spin orientation by putting it in a magnet. And in this case, the accelerator puts it in a vertical format. But I want to know when the proton is spinning upward, then how many of the quarks and gluons are in the same direction? And the way to do the experiment is to align two of these protons in a colliding mode where they are spinning opposite and compare the cross-section when they are moving along the same direction, meaning they're anti-parallel versus parallel. And that's when we collide. And the differences in the two tells us about what the spin carried by the quarks and gluons is. Now, suppose you don't have a polarized beam. You just collide two bunches. What does that mean? It means they're equal. There is a complete distribution of quarks as of the protons in all directions. There is no preferred direction for this. And that means that some of them would be completely as we wanted, but a large majority of them would be completely randomly oriented. So their collisions are not going to tell us anything about the spin. But it will tell us about QCD, the total cross-section. So that doesn't change. You can measure things like total cross-section, what are the structure functions, what are the distributions overall of the protons inside that bunch, and then hence the quarks inside the proton by having unpolarized beams. But if you start asking questions about the spin of the proton, where does that come from? You absolutely need a polarized beam. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that was really well explained. Thank you. That really clarifies it.
You've explained a lot about your research, and it's very interesting. However, we do have to move on, unfortunately, although I could listen to it all day. Could you explain what a typical day in your position is like?
Being the director of EIC Science and the center, the frontiers in nuclear science, I do have a fair bit of administrative tasks, but I do have a full research group behind me of graduate students and a set of postdocs and who are actively engaged in research. And I tend to follow each one of those activities from Jefferson Lab to RIC to EIC. So typically what I try to do is to limit the administrative part first thing in the morning. And I come in, there are administrative assistants waiting for decisions to be heard from me and what are the planning discussions, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the kind of things that are the most boring part of the day. So I want to get it done when I'm fresh and I'm not tired. The rest of the thing is more exciting, to do physics with the students, talk to students, either teach or be with the research group or be on research meetings, research-related meetings. So as far as possible, I try to get the administrative part done first in the morning in an hour and two with the administrative staff. And then I try to focus on science during the day. And typically, I try to like to go out with students, postdocs for lunch. We always have a group meeting on Fridays. It's a very well set thing before lunch, and we all go out for lunch together so that we get to know, lots of new students always coming in from undergraduate as well as graduate school. But at the same time, you build this informal rapport with the students, and I think then the discussions become a lot more easier for them as well as for me to understand, you know, what's the main problem with the issue, with the technical problem or the scientific issue, or we talk about what's new today, you know, in what did you hear in science or even outside. So I like to have a day in which I do the administrative part in the morning and then leave the whole thing, the remaining part, as far as possible. Often it's not possible because some of the meetings are forced on me in the evening or afternoon, but that's okay. That comes with the responsibilities. But typically that's what my day looks like. And then, you know, around 6:37, I go home. Earlier, until last year, I used to go home a little earlier. My kids were still at home. Now they are in college. So we both are sort of more involved in our work. We don't have strict time limits in the evening. So we are a little bit more relaxed. So I can go a little late, and that's fine.
It sounds like a reasonable balance between administrative tasks and research.
Of course, I didn't mention I do travel quite a lot for work because I'm promoting electron ion collider at various national and international levels. So that is a very significant part of my life. At least there is one trip a month to someplace. But since I like to travel and like to meet people, it's not such a burden, other than you need to adjust to timelines and then get things done when you come back in a fast-paced way. I look at it very positively. I don't look at it as a burden, but it is a part of my life.
Yeah. And I think you're good at it, talking about the EIC and stuff.
That sounds really interesting to be able to do physics and to visit a lot of places. So moving on, what would you explain to undergraduate students or first-year graduate students what your roles are or have been in the long-range plan or the past long-range plans?
So I got involved with the long-range planning for the first time in 2002. When for the first time I presented the electron ion collider in one of the town meetings of the long range plan. And then that ensued the discussion of this as being a future potential project for nuclear science. And then in 2007 and 2015, I was explicitly part of the long range planning activity. 2007, I was on NSAC, so which is the core membership, and I did participate in the long range planning. And in 2015, I was not part of the NSAC, but I was part of the long-range planning group, which is slightly expanded group that does the planning for the long-range of the nuclear science. And all of these three long-range plans that I have been involved with myself, I was part of the writing group that wrote the electron-ion collider proposal propose recommendations, initiatives, discuss them, present them, defend them in the discussions that happened within the long-range plan in the subcommittees or in the broader venues. And then towards the end of each of those plans, typically as every member of the long-range planning committee gets a homework to write something about that project that they have promoted and they have discussed or defended. And so naturally, because I was primarily involved with the EIC, I did get homeworks to write about them. So the recommendations or the initiative recommendations that happened before in the two first long-range planning activities. I worked with other members of the NSAC group, making the proposal for those statements, then finalizing them with edits that come from our group and improving them as best as we can, you know, making the articulating them very well. And then general editing of various chapters that you would get as part of being a member of the group. I think I did that. And this year, I'm not part of the long-range planning activity in that core group. However, I do get questions from the committee regarding facts of some of the scientific issues that come up with the EIC, its connection to high energy physics, its connection to IV ion physics, part of the core arguments before, but now we are expanding the scope of the electron ion collider beyond what it was really meant to be. Now it is a real project. And people are saying, hey, what else can they do? It doesn't have to be a unique thing, but it's certainly there will be something uniquely that we can contribute to some of the questions that may be in the heavy ion physics or other aspects of spin physics. So those are the kind of questions that I get from the members of the NSAC writing committee or from the members. So my role is advisory as time, and I'm happy to help at any level I can.
It's really cool that you've been involved with the long-range plan for so long. So during your time, what are some of the big things that you have seen the long-range plan accomplish?
Oh, yes. So as you probably have heard, nuclear physics long-range planning activity is considered amongst the scientific disciplines as one of the most successful planning exercise that happens every 5 to 7 years. And I'm talking about nuclear physics, particle physics, condensed matter science, astrophysics, et cetera, et cetera. It started, I believe, in the early 80s or late 70s, that the idea that we should come together and make a plan and then stick to it was some kind of unwritten, self-regulated planning effort that started in that time. And because nuclear physicists have been so disciplined about it, so we come together, we make the case for what the field needs in the next 5 to 10 years, and we make passionate arguments for our own proposals. But at the same time, we understand that the whole science, nuclear physics, is very diverse. So it's not just one thing that people work on. People like me who have worked on RIC and EIC and Jefferson Lab, they're all looking at high energy QCD, but there is neutrino-less double beta decay, which is a beautiful experiment that will decide whether the neutrino is a Majorana particle or not. And it has a very fundamental and important physics to be done there. At the same time, facilities like the radioactive isotope beams, the FRIB, at Michigan State, we just started last year. That is also important to understand the nuclear structure and its connections to nuclear astrophysics. So we appreciate this whole, what I find very fascinating is that being on this committee, being with those scientists who are of the highest caliber in each of those fields, you learn a lot from them. You learn a lot. You tell them about your passion. But eventually we come up with a plan that has a sequence that is based not only on science, but the process of realization. Just because I was so passionate about the electron ion collider in 2002 doesn't mean that it was ready to be built. In no way the machine was ready, the technology was ready, the detectors' ideas were not crystallized at that time. So science had not been fleshed out. But then because the idea was attractive, the community came together and supported me and said, okay, you need some R&D money to develop the realize the accelerator part. And we did get some money after 2002 to realize that machine. And that kind of help evolved. For each large project, this is the kind of thing that happens, that the community understands and stands behind the collective ideas, not just single idea, but all the good projects and proposals that come through the long-range planning discussion. And that's very important to acknowledge that we are not the only one, right? So we actually do make a plan in the final proposals, about 3 or 4 recommendations, followed by a 3 or 4 initiative that says, these initiatives might come after the completion of these first three recommendations. But those recommendations are planned in time, in science, in some other parameter that makes it easier for the Department of Energy to take those and start implementing them in the sequence. So I found that exercise extremely valuable, important, and it not only did I learn from this as I was passing through these various things, but I think it makes very clear sense. It's a defendable plan that the Department of Energy tries to implement. And that's what is nice about this activity. And I think that is the reason what I'm told is that all the large initiatives that came through in nuclear science have succeeded eventually in realizing. And that's very important, a statement. No other subfield seems so successful in making the plan and pursuing it and realizing those facilities. So that's something really special about nuclear science. So I've really appreciated the whole process very, very much.
So thanks. That was a really nice overview of the long-range plan. And one thing I wanted to kind of ask is, you've kind of been this core person in the EIC since the beginning. Would you say it's like kind of your brainchild?
No, I think a lot of people were involved in the early ideas with different things. I was one of them, but there were a few other initiatives of the electron ion collider. I was from the beginning keen. Well, I should step back. When I was a postdoc and explored this experimental quark distribution and the spin content at CERN, my initial instinct was to go to Hera, which was a 300 GeV center of mass electron-proton collider, to study the proton spin using polarized protons and polarized electrons, and H1 and Zeus detectors. That was my first instinct. So from 1996, I was promoting for about 3 years. I worked very hard on getting that. There, we had the electron polarization, we had the two detectors, we had the collider, but the proton beam was not polarized. So there was a technical need to polarize the proton beam, and there were accelerator physicists to try to help. And it would have been possible, not impossible, but it would have been very difficult. And it was a small project at the end of the sort of the HERA operating plans by the German government. And there were other competing large projects, because of which then this project didn't proceed. That is when I came to RIC. And there I started thinking about the electron ion collider using RIC as the source of hadron beam. And that was very natural for me because I had just worked on polarized, promoting the collider at DAISY. This was lower energy, but I understood that what I wanted to do at that time about the unmeasured fraction of momentum in the low momentum side of the quarks and gluons could be done with RIC. So I was very happy with that. And then the ideas of orbital motion, et cetera, came in during that time when we were discussing it. There were actually two other parallel efforts actually within the US that were going on. One was led by Richard Milner and ideas of having a small collider in Boston at MIT Bates using the existing infrastructure of the Bates Lab. So they had a facility and they said, well, we have all these infrastructure for experiments here. How could we extend the life of it with meaningful way? So they were thinking about building a small collider, not at the high energy that I was thinking at Brookhaven, but there was the MIT folks were thinking about that. A very similar idea was coming from Indiana University, where people like Professor Londrigan from there and Steve Wigdor et al., they wanted to use their IUCF, Indiana University Cyclotron facility, into some future collider. Again, it would have been perfect complement to join hands with MIT and Indiana University. And they did that for some while. And that was a possibility. And then eventually Richard Milner, who was the person, basically suggested, hey, if we really want to do this, let's come together and think about what's the best way forward. And I think we all came together around 2000. And that's the experimental coming together of various groups. And we met a couple of times at Yale, where I was a postdoc, also at Brookhaven, where I had moved by that time, and also at MIT in spring of 2000. Where we decided to come together, call this project the Electron Ion Collider, and all united experimentally to propose that. So I think the ideas existed. How we came together was just that history, that we were all thinking slightly differently, but we realized that coming together and bringing the community together, of course, the community was very small at that time. I'm talking about 30 people at the time, at the most. So I think it would be very difficult to say it was only my effort, but I have been there since the beginning. There were lots of people who helped at that time, very senior people who saw that this was a good idea, and they all helped us. Of course, the theory was very important. So people like Raju Venugopalan, Larry McLaren at Brookhaven, there were people who had thought about polarized proton beams at high energy and what they could do. People like Altarelli at CERN, they were very supportive of this idea. Bjorkane himself was very supportive of both nuclei as well as polarized protons. T.D. Lee from Brookhaven and Columbia, he was very supportive of this idea. Vernon Hughes was a professor at Yale who was a pioneer in spin physics. Also, my postdoc mentor was very supportive. So I think it would be wrong to say it was a single person's idea. It never was. But what happens is people doing different kinds of experiments hit limits of their technology. And then they ask a question. If I want to solve this problem, what do I need to do? Then they come up with the solution to it, which means that you need to now do a different kind of experiment. The things that they might be measuring might be very different, three different groups. Their interest might be different. But it turns out that because all the phase parameters of a fixed target experiment had been explored, we were all going to higher energy. We were all pointing to going to lower momentum fraction and all pointing to go in measuring more exclusive measurements rather than what we were doing at the time. So all were pointing to the same concept. The question was, which project, which detailed, which facility was the ideal one? Was it the MIT Bates upgrade? Was it the IUCF upgrade? Or was it upgrade of a RIC facility? And we fortunately came to the right answer altogether. So I happened to be lucky enough to start with, but that doesn't mean that was the only one. I think a lot of other people jumped in those years.
That's awesome. Thank you for that history.
Also, let me just continue if I may. If you have this idea and you start getting more ideas at that stage, it always builds the community, which was very, very critical. And over the next few years of 2002, when the first time that this collider was presented at the long-range planning discussions and was eventually written, we got a lot of enthusiastic help from various people and various countries. And that early help and early encouragement was very, very valuable. Just so many people came into the project during those 4 or 5 years. It was quite amazing. By the time we went to this 2007 long-range plan, we already had like 200 people behind us instead of 30. And then the next step were like 750 or 900 people. And now, if you look at the user group, it's like 1,400 people from around the world. So a good idea always gets support, but it's never one person's contribution. It's a collective that helps.
Yeah. Thank you for the explanation of how things come together to create a new particle accelerator. Let's see. So because of my position as someone who was there and your position as one of the organizers, we were wondering if you could explain some about the EIC summer school that was in June this year and what that was all about and what its goal is.
Yeah. So one of the things that I always worry when I look back at the whole project and look into the future, these projects are very long lifetimes. I mean, it's been 20 years before it was approved from the first presentation at a long-range plan, and it still has 10 more years before the first collisions will happen. So it has always been my intention to make sure that not only the people who have done electron scattering be part of this, but also those who are not part of the electron scattering, like people at RIC, people at LHC, they get to learn something about the electron scattering, and maybe they can come into the project when we actually need a large workforce in the future to actually run this experiment at Brookhaven, the EIC. So it's always been my idea that we would start a summer school dedicated to the electron-ion collider. And as soon as we got the resources, thanks to the Simons Foundation, which supports the Center for Frontiers in Nuclear Science, primarily focused at supporting the electron-ion collider, I wanted to start creating a next generation of students and postdocs that will become leaders in the operational period of the electron-ion collider. And that was my simple idea. I mean, there are very general QCD schools like CITEC school or HUC school that is focused slightly more on the electron scattering at Jefferson Lab. There are other national and international schools. But I felt that we could do something slightly different in the sense that we will not only focus on the EIC, but also help people connect to high energy and other aspects of physics. So that's why I started it in 2019. And now we just had in June, a fourth of such schools. For the first time, we did it jointly with CTEC collaboration, which was also a tremendous opportunity for us to learn from their generous experience of 30 years of running that school. So I think we did very well in doing that. And I think the school, it was much better for it. Secondly, most of the schools are supported by the DOE and NSF, and we really appreciate that. Over years, they have created so many young scientists and have exposed them to the specifics of high energy QCD and standard model and all that. However, limited money can be spent on foreign school students. In my vision of this school, I wanted to be independent of nationality. I didn't want that to be the constraint. And I wanted to really see if we can get students from all over the world. And that was what Simons Foundation money allows me to do, is to have no constraints. So I can support equally likely a person from China or India or Japan or Europe as I can support a U.S. permanent resident or a citizen. And I think that we are doing it very well, you know, so far. I don't know whether you saw the final plot of the distribution. So far, had about 180 students from 26 countries that came to us over the last 4 years for these summer schools. And I'm very glad because most of them are engaged and keep on engaging. They are participating in and helping the simulation studies, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that this kind of a workforce grows and we can get people from all over the world with all backgrounds to come and work on the electron-ion collider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can say personally, it was an amazing experience and that, yeah, it really helped me understand my place in the physics community, and is having all the international students there was an amazing experience to get to share with them.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that international students get the chance to attend such a school, and it's a great opportunity for physics community to collaborate and learn about each other and their experiences. So you've mentioned a lot of great things that you have done in your career and a lot of accomplishments, but when and how did you decide to become a physicist?
Okay, I can probably tell you exactly the day. I don't remember the exact date, but I know that I remember the day. So I am a very lazy person. I don't like to recite things without understanding them. And there was a class, I was in the 11th grade or 12th, but there was a class on biology and particularly plant sciences, botany. And the teacher came and said that you need to, remember these 150 Latin names of plants and whatever. And, you know, I was student in India, didn't have a connection to Latin, so I didn't know how to intuitively remember those names. And I thought this was a complete disaster. I would fail this class. Following that class was a physics class in which the professor was teaching us about projectile motion. And first thing he told us was that, hey, you don't need to remember anything. You need to know this fundamental law of gravity. And then if you really know those basics, you can calculate things on your own. You don't need to remember anything. You can know how far the projectile will go, how high it will go. And I said, wow, that is the field for me, because that's the place where I don't need to remember anything, but I can deduce myself all the things that once I understand the basic principles of that science. So I think that was one of the early times I remember thinking, okay, this might be the field for me. But I had read something, you know, the first 3 minutes by Weinberg, a book I think must have been published in the late 80s or early 80s. I was in high school, even below 11th grade. First 3 minutes was about the first 3 minutes of the universe and how universe might have come about and what we knew about it at that time. And that was very fascinating to me, that description of how it might have begun. And I was very curious about that. Little did I know that I would get involved with Rick physics and actually do the mini bangs with nuclear collisions, Phoenix experiment, 30, 40 years later. I think those were the kind of early influences. I was blessed to have extremely good teachers in physics. And also, I think contrary to set of parenthood at that time in India, where every good student was encouraged to either become a doctor or an engineer, my family background was open enough. They said, okay, if you want to do that, you should go in that direction, it should be fine. And so all of this sort of helped. I think a set of very good teachers, some flexibility and freedom in thinking and pursuing what I wanted to do. All of that did come about.
That's really awesome. I kind of had a similar experience where it's like, oh, I hate memorizing. Oh, gravity. That's all I need to know.
Yes.
I would just like to add that my experience, I was like, okay, I can just do calculations. Perfect.
Good.
All right. So moving on, kind of related. What obstacles have you encountered along the way of getting to where you are? I don't know if maybe coming from India was a difficulty. And beyond that, I know you've explicitly said two-body problem was a...
Coming from India, I think at that time, which was late 80s, since I knew I was going to do experimental particle and nuclear physics, given I had prepared myself to come to either CERN or some laboratory like that in Europe, or most often, US is in many aspects the most welcoming country in the way of immigration for scientists or any other professional. So that was not such a large distance. So when I came for my PhD in 1987-88, that was not the biggest issue. My girlfriend at the time was back in India. She was still continuing. And so there was a time when it was expensive to go back for her to travel. We were away from the first 2 years when we came. And then only after my qualifying exams, I could go back and meet the rest of the family and her, of course. And then we got married. She also came for a grad school here, not Yale where I was, but 100 miles away. And that was perfectly fine. But after graduation, getting a job, she's not in physics, which is considered fortunate or unfortunate. Depends upon how it works out. We always had this issue of, you know, finding a place to go to and then see the other person adjust. And that's what we have pursued. Whoever gets the best first option, the other person sort of follows and say, okay, we'll do the best of that. And then there always will be other normalizing factors that will come in the future. And that's fortunately has worked. So the first time I got the postdoc position at CERN, I went there, and then fortunately, she got a postdoc in the University of Geneva just a couple of months later after we moved there. So she took that risk, and I appreciate that very much. It was not completely given at all that she would have a continuing career. At the same time, when we came back here, it was a time when, you know, she was a lot more employable in terms of she's a pharmaceutical scientist, so there are more pharmacies than universities. So the opportunities for her were more. And so we decided that we'll just do the opposite once we did that. Turns out that we both got opportunities on Long Island when we moved to Brookhaven very quickly. And that was very important that she also was involved in her career that she wanted. There were other opportunities that I got during that time to go somewhere else, rather prestigious places. However, I refused to go there because that would have been more difficult for her. With the family, we had young children at that time. And if I were to come to Rick all the time, then that would have been an extra burden for her in her career. So we decided that we'll stick together as a family group. If both of us were happier, that was the better idea to, you know, that's how we chose places where we went. And we have never regretted that, you know, being at Brookhaven, Stony Brook, and then her having a career in pharmaceutical science here on Long Island has always worked out so far. There were times when we had to make those decisions, and it's always 2 + 2 is more than 5, the way we looked at it. And when postdocs, students come to me for advice, I always tell them, don't focus on one career. Look at the both and see where you will do better as a unit rather than a single person. And even if one thing looks most attractive, it's always important to consider what happens to the other person in such things. I always say they're not two-body problems, they're two-body opportunities. And I think that's really important. And I really mean that. I think that's really an opportunity. Two happy people are working together, are working in different areas, but working together, they benefit both those working areas and the family itself. So I think that's really important. I don't call it a two-body problem. It's really an opportunity.
That's amazing. Thank you for talking about that. And I wrote that down, not a two-body problem, but a two-body opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because I'm in a similar boat and do think physicists plus biomedical science people make a good pair.
It's a good pair.
I mean, that was really interesting, and you had a really nice take on it and how you dealt with the situation through your life. But seeing where you are, I think it did work out perfectly. So My next question is, what do you do to relax? Do you have a special hobby, a special thing, or a special place where you like to go to relax when you're not doing physics?
Oh, I like to read. I dabble with music a little bit. I listen to a lot of music, classical as well as light Indian classical music. I play an instrument called the harmonium, which is like a very mini piano, but it's not a string instrument. It's a air pump. It's more like an accordion, you should say. Yeah, so I do that to relax. I like to walk. I'm not a good runner, but I do like to walk. I like to swim. But reading is really the other part. And somehow I feel the importance of science in society is a major part of my thinking when I'm not thinking directly physics. So I really spend a lot of time trying to think about what's going on in politics, but related to how science can help. It's a lot of meaningful contribution that we can make to the society. And through the discussions that go on now, like the environmental issues, nuclear proliferation, all of those are near and dear and where to heart for nuclear physicists. So I think we can be very broadly engaged with the society. So I do take my extra time to talk to students in the area, you know, our college students, but also high school students with my local school. Whenever they invite me, I'm very glad to talk to them about these issues because they are the ones I think are going to be feeling the effect of all the things bad that might happen if we are not responsible now. And at the same time, they can be the architects of change. So I really do read a lot about these issues, politics, science, and society. But I do write about it. I haven't published anything, but I do want to eventually come up with something like this.
Yeah, I mean, that's really cool and interesting too. I mean, I also often wonder about how science has a huge role in politics and actually making a change. And it's really nice to hear that.
I teach a course called Physics for Future Presidents. And that might be at a local level or can be a state level, or it can be a private industry level. You know, the people have to understand that anything that you do has a consequence and it's meaningful impact on the society. So all of these issues of environmental cleanliness and nuclear issues and sustainability and alternate sources of energy, all of these is simple things that every citizen should know, in my opinion, in the modern world. And I think that's the part which I try to impress upon students, which are very broad in that class. It's not physics only. It's a university level course. So I really like to learn and talk to them about this because they give us perspectives that often we don't get without talking to people, right? So that's what I spend a lot of time on.
That's great. With that last question, I think this leads into the final question. And that is, what advice do you have for students or young researchers?
advice. Just follow your passion. Really, really. That's the most important thing. You know, you have to remember that you're going to pick something that is going to last for you with you in your life for more than 30 years, typically. As you're a student, you've never spent anything like that on any particular institution, at any particular institution or any particular topic. So you better choose what you really, really like to do. And if that means that you want to be in academia, you know, that's great. But if that means that you want to be in a private sector doing something that you can utilize your skills that you've gained, may that be the truth. There's nothing wrong with pursuing that. As long as you are aware of all those, of the science and the impact of science on society, you can be ambassadors. Everyone cannot be and does not need to be a pure scientist. They can be friends of science and they can be very valuable as well. You can be politicians. You can take real science and have real impact. You know, evidence-based reasoning is important. That's what we teach. It's not the science. It's the methods of science that need to be applied. So, yeah, just follow the passion. That's the most important thing. Be happy. Find out what's really going to make you happy. And that's probably where you will be successful the most because it will not be a burden to go to work every day for those activities.
Great. I think that's really good advice. Thank you so much, Abe, for your time.
You're welcome.
It's been amazing, and I've learned a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Kinza.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Huiwin Lin. This episode was hosted by Bill Good and Kinza Hassan, edited by Esther Cohen Lin. Thanks for listening.